All right, we're going to be in Luke chapter 9 is where we left off. If you're visiting, that's what we do. We just go through the whole Bible, chapter, verse. Thursdays, we're going through, we're just getting towards the end of Numbers, after which we'll head into Deuteronomy, and Sunday mornings, we're in Luke. And Sunday nights, we're getting close to Hebrews, but we took a couple weeks off from verse by verse to just go through some of the basics of the faith, some of the basics of Christianity. We'll back up just a hair to, let's say, verse 18 of Luke chapter 9. It says this, "And it came to pass, as he was alone praying, his disciples were with him, and he asked them, saying, Whom say the people that I am?" And again, we covered this a little bit last week. It wasn't, who should I be so that people like me? It was, who's everybody talking about saying that I am? And they answering said, John the Baptist. But some say Elijah, and others say that one of the old prophets is risen again. And he said unto them, But who do you say that I am? And Peter answering said, The Christ of God. And he straitly charged them and commanded them to tell no man that thing, saying, The Son of Man must suffer many things, and be rejected of the elders, and the chief priests, and scribes, and be slain, and be raised on the third day. And we mentioned last week, that is the question. In verse 20, it doesn't matter what everybody else says. Who does Jesus say? Who do you think he is? It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. Who do you say that I am? And we kind of mentioned the little three choices that I think it was Josh McDowell put it together in that form of, he's either a lunatic, he's crazy because of the things that he said, or he's just flat out lying because of some of the things he said, or he actually is the Lord, he is God. And for each person, that is a decision you have to make. Where do you stand on Jesus Christ? He's the one man who came and drew a line, and everybody is going to be on one side of that line or the other. Even when they talked to him, we mentioned this last week, he said, Do you think I came to bring peace? No, a sword. He came to bring division, because everybody is divided over who he is. And Peter answered, said, The Christ of God. And of course, if you read that account in the other Gospels, Jesus tells him, blessed are you, Peter Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And Peter says something intelligent, and the Lord obviously knows that has to come from God, because Peter is not in the habit of saying things intelligent. In fact, as we're going to see, Peter has chronic foot and mouth disease, and he's going to exercise his gift again in a few minutes. But then as soon as he said that, he says, okay, don't tell anybody, all right? That's great. I'm glad you know. But you don't understand what that means. I don't want you being my press agent right now, because, yes, that's true, but you don't really understand. And he started telling them in verse 22, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be slain and be raised the third day. And, they knew the truth. Okay, I am the Messiah. You're the Christ. You're the Messiah. But they really didn't understand the implication of that. And you guys understand, there's the idea of having right, I guess you maybe have some knowledge, but you don't really understand the full implication, or you don't understand how to apply it. I remember when I was in college, I started out in computer science with electrical engineering, and it was really hard, I mean, I liked doing math and stuff, but then it got to the point where I get into the physics class, and it was, this wasn't playing around. This was real stuff. And you take your first quiz and you bomb it badly, and you think, yeah, but I'm a smart guy. I don't bomb things. And then you realize, well, I didn't know all the formulas, how to do it. So we were allowed a page of notes into this stuff. So me and another one of my friends said, well, we'll just write down all the formulas, and we'll just find all the formulas in the book, and we'll just write them down, and then we'll be fine. And so we did. You write down all your formulas. I remember there was the whole, even the simple ones for math, the Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, right? You guys all know that, except for, what does that mean? Well, I don't know. But we better write it down, because we might need it on the test. And so we write down all these formulas, and we get into the test, and it's like, okay, what do I do with them? I got them, but which one do I use? It's just a bunch of letters and numbers. And these guys were the same boat. They knew Jesus was a Christ, but in their mind, the Messiah, the one who was going to come, was coming to deliver them from Rome, because Israel at this point was under subject of Rome. They were not; they lost the ability to self-govern themselves. In fact, we know that they had lost at this point the ability of the religious leaders to give the death penalty, which is prescribed throughout their religious law, was taken away from them. And that's why when they went to crucify Jesus, they had to go to Pilate. Pilate says, well, you take care of it. And they said, we can't. because we can't put a man to death. And so they were looking for somebody to come on the scene and get them out of Rome, to deliver them from their occupation problem with Rome. What they didn't understand is that's not what the Messiah was all about, because their real problem was not bondage to Rome, it was bondage to sin. The fact that they had no way to escape from the sin nature that they were born with. And so even though Peter and the others now, when Peter said it, knew that he was the Messiah, they didn't really know what that meant. And so he starts to tell them what that means. And because they're looking for him to set up kingdom, and they're figuring, okay, we're in the top 12 here, we're the apostles, we're going to have seats, we're going to be in power, he's going to rule, and you know, we'll be the number one guys. And he starts telling them right off the bat, no, I'm going to suffer a lot of stuff, I'm going to be rejected, be slain and raised the third day. But they don't get it. It's going to tell us again in a few minutes. They still didn't understand. And he said in verse 23 to them, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. If any man, and again, you know, for those of you who come from a strict Calvinist background, you'll note again and again, and if you're not familiar with Calvinism, great, that's fine, just go with what the Bible says. But John Calvin was a theologian, and one of his points was he believed that man was totally depraved and completely unable to respond, and that not only that, Christ died, but there was what's called limited atonement, which means he didn't die for anybody. He only died for particular ones that he chose to save, and you have no say in whether or not you can't receive the Lord. It's only if he decides to say, I want you saved. Because if he wants you to be saved, you're going to be saved. And if he doesn't, doesn't matter, you got no shot. But yet you read through the gospel and you see over and over again, if any man, whosoever will, you know, words like that, choices put to all men, and we all have a choice to make. Certainly God is sovereign and he does as he wills, but part of his sovereignty was to give us the ability to choose. And so he says, if anyone wants to come after me, let him deny himself, not self-denial, we talked about that last week, but denying self, taking up his cross daily. I wish he could have left that word out. Just take it up once. But no, it's a daily thing, and follow him. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever will lose his life for my sake, the same shall save it. For what is a man advantaged if he gain the whole world and lose himself or be cast away? And that is, he takes it to the ultimate extreme. You know, if you're going to sell out, what are you going to sell out for? $100, $200, pretty car, pretty woman, you know, whatever it is, whatever your price is. Well, what if you had it all, the whole world? But the truth is, the whole world is perishing, but yet we're eternal. And so what does it matter if you gain something temporary, but you lose that which is eternal? He says in verse 26, and this is about where we left off, for whomsoever shall be ashamed of me and of my words, of him shall the Son of Man be ashamed, when he shall come in his own glory and in his Father's and of the holy angels. Whosoever shall be ashamed of me. I don't know what your experience was growing up. You ever spent time at a church that you were really ashamed that you went there? I mean, there was nothing else. You'd had no choice. But I remember when I was a kid, even though we went to my parents had a church in their house, somewhere in the summer, somebody got me to go to a vacation Bible school at another church in town. And it was really hokey, you know. You went, you had to go, and they played the games and everything. And it was kind of like, I'm here, but I really don't want to tell anybody I'm here because it's just so hokey, you know. But they had, in true fashion of the way it was, they knew it was hokey and you weren't ever going to bring anybody out. So they bribed you to bring other people out. There was a whole box of toys, of things that you might want. And all you had to do was bring a friend and you get some. And there was, in that box, there was this big super rubber ball, you know, one of those ones that'll bounce like a mile, and I wanted that ball. I wanted it bad. I really wanted it bad. But I went through the whole week, like, with this struggle, like, I want the ball, and I have a friend I could ask, and I know he'd come because we hung out all the time. But it was so stinking hokey, I didn't want to bring him because it's like, man, it's just, you know, yeah, I know I'm going there, but we'll get a prize. We'll both get a prize. Come on. And I finally, by the end of the week, I drug him out and did it. And, you know, all of us, well, many of us may have been in religious systems before. We're just ashamed of. I mean, because they did stupid things, they acted weird. You know, one thing that I see over and over again as I go through the Gospels, wherever Jesus went, everybody flocked to him. They liked to eat with him, they liked to have him over for dinner, they liked to hang out with him, they liked to talk to him, they liked to bring their kids to him, which is definitive proof that he wasn't weird, you know? Because you've seen, you know, there's nothing that says you have to have like a really bad comb over or you have to talk like a used car salesman or whatever to be a Christian. You really don't. Jesus was supernaturally natural, so much so that everybody wanted to be around him. And I think as believers, we're to be the same way. That people should look at us and say, man, you're just weird, you know? Because truth be told, a lot of churches, if you acted in the mall like people do in those churches, they'd wrap you up and take you away. You know, if you're just acting like complete idiots, and for some reason people seem to think that being spiritual means being weird, and yet you don't have to be. There's no, you know, and truly, he doesn't talk about a religious system. He doesn't talk about a church. He talks about his relationship with them. He says, whosoever shall be ashamed of me, in my words, of him shall the Son of Man be ashamed. Because there's nothing about what Jesus said or what Jesus did that should make us ashamed. I mean, he sacrificed himself for us. He died for us. You know, and Paul was at that point. He says in Romans 1:16, he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. And Paul had got to that place where he said, hey, I'm not ashamed of it. You know, even though he had been persecuting the church to the point of consenting to Christians being stoned and being ready to drag off believers to prison for confessing Christ, when the Lord changed his heart, he was not ashamed. And then he goes on in verse 27 back in Luke 9. He says, but I tell you of a truth, there be some standing here which shall not taste death till they see the kingdom of God. Now you got to figure at this point, his disciples who are still thinking that he's getting ready to set up, you know, kingdom here on earth, are thinking, yeah, it's coming, man. Time's short. It's, of course, that whole phrase about some standing here shall not taste death is probably bothering them a little bit, like maybe some will. But they're thinking, see the kingdom when he sets up his throne. But we're going to see in the next couple verses, no, it actually happened about 8 days later. Because it says it came to pass about 8 days after these sayings, he took Peter, John, and James and went up into a mountain to pray. And as he prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered, and his raiment was white and glistering. And behold, there talked with him two men, which were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory, and spake of his decease, which should be accomplished in Jerusalem. So he grabs the three that he were closest to him, and we see these same three picked out time and again when he goes in and he raises Jairus' daughter. He keeps everybody else outside, but he takes Peter, James, and John, and he takes them up to a mountain to pray. Not sure exactly which mountain, probably Mount Hermon, but it doesn't particularly matter. He was up in the mountain, and he's praying. And as he prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered. When you look at the other Gospels, Matthew and Mark also describe the same set of events, and it talks about him being transfigured. We call this the Mount of Transfiguration. And literally that word transfigured, when you look at the Greek behind it, it's the word that metamorphosis comes from. It means to be changed. It doesn't mean to be turned into something else. What it means is what's inside comes out. You see the true thing. And here, he goes up there to pray, and in the middle of that, all of a sudden, what's really on the inside of Jesus comes to the outside, and it says his raiment was white and glistening. Literally, it was his whole countenance, his clothing, everything he was wearing was radiant. It was glowing. It was bright. And it said, behold, there talked with him two men, which were Moses and Elijah. Now, interesting, these two show up on the scene. First of all, it says there were two men. Well, let me just read a couple more verses so you get the feel of it. Who appeared in glory and spake of his decease, which should be accomplished at Jerusalem. But Peter and they that were with him were heavy with sleep. And when they were awake, they saw his glory and the two men that stood with him. And it came to pass, as they departed from him, Peter said unto Jesus, Master, it's good for us to be here. Let us make three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. So all of a sudden, of course, Jesus goes up to pray, and those three guys fall asleep. They can't stay awake. So he's praying, and he's metamorphosed. What's the true person appears, and Moses and Elijah show up. And, you know, I'm thinking they didn't have name tags that says, hi, my name is Moses. Hi, I'm Elijah. You know, these are guys who died hundreds or thousands of years ago, and yet instinctively, Peter, James, and John, and it wasn't because, you know, everybody had an Elijah picture on their wall or the currency had Moses on it. It was just they knew. They just somehow knew when they saw those two guys, that's who it was. And, of course, you know, there's a lot of people who have that question. Well, when we die and we go to heaven, will we recognize each other? Because, I mean, it says in there, you know, Jesus says that when in heaven we're not married and given in marriage like we are on earth, that will we even know each other? You know, I mean, I don't personally think when we get to heaven we're going to be stupider than we are now. I mean, I recognize most of you now, so I'm guessing probably we will then. But even here we see they recognized automatically. That's Moses and that's Elijah. Even though they were dead, they were still... Well, actually, Elijah, it's funny when you look at these two guys. Moses... And he, by the way, was the lawgiver. He was the one who brought, who he wrote the first five books. He's the one who received the Ten Commandments and the Levitical law and brought it to the people. And certainly in one way, he represents the law. His death was kind of odd. It tells us in Deuteronomy when he died, he went up on top of a mountain. He was 120 years old, and it says that his eye had not dimmed and his natural forces had not abated, but yet the Lord took him and buried his body. And then there's that weird little section in Jude where it mentions something about Michael the archangel contending with Satan over Moses' body. I don't know what that's about. I wish we had more information. And then Elijah. Elijah was one of the two people in the Bible who never died. He was walking with Elisha, and then chariot came, and he got caught up into heaven in a whirlwind. And Elijah was one of the prophets, probably one of the greatest prophets. And so when you look at these two, on one hand, you've got the representation of the law and of the prophets speaking with the Lord. Now, I think it's interesting also that these two guys who had very particular ministries when they were on earth were the ones talking with them, because when you get to Revelation chapter 11, just as kind of an aside, it's talking about the tribulation period, and there's these two guys who show up for about half of that. And just let me read this in Revelation chapter 11, verse 3. It says this, "And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the Lord of the earth. And if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoured their enemies." You remember what Elijah did? One of his big miracles was when he was having the contest with the prophets of Baal, and he called down fire from heaven. "And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. They have power to shut up heaven, that it rain not in the days of their prophecy." You remember Elijah prayed 3.5 years, didn't rain, prayed again, it rained. "And have power over waters to turn them to blood." You remember Moses when he went out to Pharaoh, first of the plagues, turned the Nile into blood. "And to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will." And it seems to me that those two guys are going to be back on the scene again during the tribulation period, and that's possibly part of the reason why they're here with the Lord. But it's interesting, the three of them there talking, they're in glory, he is transfigured. It says in verse 31 back in Luke 9, "who appeared in glory and spake of his decease, which he should accomplish at Jerusalem." Talking about him dying, you know, by itself, dying doesn't seem to be that great of an accomplishment. Pretty much all of us manage to do it at some point in our life. We try to put it off, but everybody accomplishes it. Actually, the word that is translated deceased there, the Greek word is exodus, and spoke of his exodus. Now, here's Moses. Of course, we're studying the Exodus on Thursday nights, where he brought the people, the Israelites, out of the bondage of Egypt and their exodus out of that. But yet, in doing that, he brought them out of that situation, but they still were in bondage to sin. Elijah, his part of his ministry was going against idolatry, because the people were all taken up in idolatry, and his stand against the prophets of Baal there helped deliver the people, bring their exodus out of bondage to idolatry, but yet they fell right back into it again. And so now they're talking with the Lord about the exodus that he's going to have, which will be complete, it'll be thorough, it'll be a victory over sin. "But Peter and they that were with him were heavy with sleep." And, you know, I can relate to that verse. I don't know about you. If you ever have problems sleeping at night, just hop off the bed, get on your knees, and start to pray. And magically, better than any, you know, better than NyQuil or whatever you would take, just it comes. You know, you start doing the bob and drool. You want to pray. You want to stay awake. And yet somehow that's part of the warfare. It's difficult. And they were asleep. But then you've also been in bed. You know, I was one of those. I was kind of a late person. Some people are like early to bed, early to rise. I don't know what's wrong with you. I'm late to bed, late to rise. I like to sleep in late, you know. And the difficult part of sleeping in late is the light. Winter, it's not bad because it stays dark, but summertime, you know, it's like 8 in the morning, the sun's up. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's just pouring in through your shades, you know. And you want to sleep, but yet there's that light, and you're just fighting it. Well, these guys, they're sacking out on top of the mountain, and all of a sudden, Jesus starts glowing, and brighter than bright. And so apparently it wakes them up, and they see what's going on, and then Moses and Elijah start to leave. And it says, Peter said unto Jesus, he doesn't know what he's saying here. And he says, Master, it's good for us to be here. You know, Lord, it's a good thing we're here. Huh? Let's make some tents. Yeah, we'll make some little booths. One for you and one for Moses and Elijah. And it says, because he didn't know what he said. Now, you know, James and John are looking at him like, what are you talking about? You know, I mean, he doesn't know what he's talking about. In fact, Proverbs 17:28 says, even a fool, when he holds his peace, is counted wise. And he that shutteth his lips is esteemed a man of understanding. Abraham Lincoln kind of turned that around a little bit. He said, it's better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to speak out and remove all doubt. And Peter just doesn't know what to do, so he starts talking. And he says something stupid. And look at this, verse 34. While he thus spake, he's in the process of saying stupid things, there came a cloud and overshadowed them, and they feared as they entered into the cloud. And there came a voice out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved son, hear him. Now, Matthew tells us it's a bright cloud. It's not a dark cloud, but it's a cloud of light shows up. And out of the middle of it comes God the Father speaking from heaven. And as Peter's blathering on, God says, this is my son. Listen to him. You know, as in, Pete, shut up and listen. Would you please? We don't need anything from you here. You're to be a witness to this event, you know. He's the only man verbally rebuked by God the Father from heaven directly. And it says they, you know, Matthew tells us they just do a face plant. As soon as they hear the voice, they see the cloud, boom, they're on their faces scared to death. And then when they look up in verse 36, when the voice was passed, Jesus was found alone. And they kept it close, and they told no man in those days any of those things which they had seen. And again, if you read the other gospel accounts, it's because he told them not to. He said, don't tell anybody about this. Again, he's saying, look, you guys still don't understand what's going on. You know, part of that voice coming from heaven, Peter is saying, well, let's build three little places. We'll just stay here. We'll hang out here, Lord. We'll build a little hut for you and for Moses and for Elijah. We've got these three great people. And it's almost as if God is saying, no, 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 that's my son. You listen to him. I mean, yes, you've got the witness of the law. You've got the witness of the prophets. But he's just not another prophet. He's just not another man of God. He is God. And you listen to what he has to say. And so he tells them, you know, don't tell anybody. And so now they're going down the hill. And you know, these guys have been living with Jesus for 2-3 years now. They've been walking with him everywhere. They've been eating with him. They've been sleeping with him. They've been listening to him teach. You know each other. You begin to know each other when you hang out with people. You know, I've over the last couple of years of doing the church here, I've hung out with Josh, I've hung out with Bob and Jamie and Alan and some of you other guys, and you get to know things about people as you hang out with them. You get to know what they like to eat. You get to know the funny little sayings. In fact, you sort of adopt those little sayings. There's things that, you know, little twists of speech, and all of a sudden you're using the same thing. And these were guys who had hung out with Jesus, and they really thought they knew him. And yet all of a sudden they get up on the mountain and what's on the inside comes out and they suddenly realize, I didn't know him like I thought I knew him. Now they see him in a whole different light. And, you know, it's interesting. Their whole life, these 3 years, has been an ongoing process of increasing revelation of who the Lord is. You know, it all started out with Jesus walking by and saying, you know, Pete, come on, let's go, follow me. And they follow him. And maybe they heard a few things about him ahead of time, and they decide, I'm going to follow him. And they think he's a great teacher, so I'll follow him as a great teacher. And then, you know, they start going through things. They start going through the storm when he's in the boat, and they suddenly realize he's the authority to calm the storm. Or they see him, you know, heal the sick, and they realize he's got more power than they thought. They see him do the miracle of feeding the 5,000, and he's making something from nothing. He's got the power of creation. And now they get up in the mountain, and they see, all of a sudden, the Jesus that they thought they knew, and they, you know, they knew where his hair stuck up, and they knew the little wrinkles in his skin, and they knew everything about him. All of a sudden, they realize there's something inside they never knew it was there. And you got to figure all the way down the hill, they're looking for a zipper on the back of his head. I mean, they got to be thinking, what is inside him? I mean, I don't understand this at all. In fact, you know, you see, like when they get to the Garden of Gethsemane and all the soldiers come to arrest Jesus, and Peter kind of wakes up out of his sleep, sees everybody around, pulls out a sword and hacks off somebody's ear. I mean, you know, Peter's always doing the wrong thing, but you got to give it to him. I mean, here's, you know, hundreds of soldiers showing up, and Peter sees Jesus and pulls out the sword, and he's got to be thinking, he's going to do the glow thing again. Watch this, man. It's coming. It's, you know, I'll come to this. We got it, baby. Me and you. We're, you know, because he figures the inside's going to come out. Of course, again, he proves that he doesn't understand, because Jesus is like, no. Put away your sword. No, it's not now. But from this standpoint forward, they're not going to look at him the same. You know, and for our lives, you go through your life and you start out and maybe you hear the gospel and you respond and all you hear is you're a sinner and you say, you're right, I am. Something rings true when you realize how, you know, that you are a sinner. You don't even then realize how bad a one you are, but then you respond and then it's a gradual process of the Lord revealing more and more of himself to you. And you find different situations where all of a sudden you realize you're not sufficient and you see a new side of Christ and it totally messes with your mind about, wow, I can trust him in that. I'm sick and I can trust him. I'm poor and I can trust him. Whatever it is, I can trust him because he reveals himself to you in a different way. And that's where these guys are. They're coming down the hill. And it says, and it came to pass on the next day when they were come down from the hill, much people met him. And behold, a man of the company cried out, saying, Master, I beseech thee, look upon my son, for he is my only child. And lo, a spirit taketh him, and he suddenly crieth out and teareth him, that he foameth again, and bruising him hardly departeth from him. And I besought thy disciples to cast him out, and they could not. And so they come down the hill, and they immediately run into a possessed kid. Now, just as an aside, this is how it works. Whenever you have that mountaintop experience, it's immediately followed by a little piece of hell on earth in your home. You know, you wait. You ladies who are going to the retreat, you'll go and you'll have a great time and the Lord will speak to you. And you'll be like, oh, this is super. And you'll come home and the kids will puke on you and, you know, everything will break and the car won't work. And I mean, it's just the way it happens. You know, right after you get this great revelation, and you can understand why Peter wants to build a little hut. Let's just stay right here because I don't want to go home. I'm going to stay here because when I get home, it's back to my husband again. You know, I got to deal with him or I got to... I'm sure that's not like that for you. It's just my wife. But whatever the case, you know, and they get down the hill and there's craziness going on. Now, all of these things are in the same order and the same things in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And it's not by chance. Now, if you go through the Gospels, you'll understand they're not all in chronological order. You would think telling a story maybe that they would just go start from the start and go to the end and put events in the order they happen, but they don't because each of the Gospels are written with a different perspective. Matthew, the usually formerly called Levi, the one with the religious background who quotes the Old Testament 99 times more than the other Gospels together, writes his Gospel to specifically show Jesus as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. He starts his genealogy with Abraham because he's pointing out the fact that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. Mark, different perspective, no genealogy. Mark portrays him as the suffering servant, and who cares the lineage of a slave, and shows his servanthood. Luke does his gospel, and he goes all the way back to Adam with his genealogy because he shows the humanity of Christ. He shows that he is the Son of Man. And then John, he has a genealogy of a type. His is, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he's showing the fact that Jesus was the Son of God and showing the four different sides. But because of that, they don't all tell the same things. They recall different events that happen in different times to bring specific understanding about who Jesus is and what he did. And so, but these ones are all tied together. When you look in all of their accounts, they're all, you've got the going up on the hill, the Mount of Transfiguration, followed by coming down into the demon-possessed son. And all of them give a little bit different information. Mark has a couple, tells the same thing, and I want to go to that for just a minute, and we'll read down through that one, because he brings out a couple points that help you understand what's going on. Because in Luke, and it's Mark chapter 9, verse 14, if you want to turn there, in Luke, it says they come down, and much people met him, and then behold, a man cried out. Mark gives you a little bit different perspective. He says, when he came with his disciples in Mark 9:14, he saw a great multitude about them and the scribes questioning with them. And straightway all the people, when they beheld him, were greatly amazed, and running to him, saluted him. And he asked the scribes, what question are you with them? What are you talking to them about? And then one of the multitude answered and said, Master, I have brought unto thee my son, which has a dumb spirit. And wheresoever he taketh him, he teareth him, he foameth, he gnashes with his teeth, and pines away. And I spake to thy disciples that they should cast him out, and they could not. What happens is this guy has a problem, and the scribes, who were the doctors of the law, they were the ones who would record the scriptures. They would know the Bible. They had no answer. They were part of the religious system of the day. They had no help for this guy. And again, we know that because there are a lot of religious institutions today that have ritual and they have works that you can perform, but they got no answer for our problems. They got no answer for the sin problem, because it's all about something you can do, and yet the message of the Bible is you can't do anything, God can do. And so the religious system had completely failed this guy, so they brought him to Jesus' disciples, who apparently tried to help him and were not able. And so the religious leaders, even though they couldn't help the guy, they were using it as an opportunity to slam the disciples. Of course, Jesus wasn't on the scene. And this is a classic scene. This has been repeated over and over throughout history. It's one that's been captured on films a lot that I have personally enjoyed watching. I don't know if you've ever spent any time watching the old badly dubbed kung fu movies on TV. You've seen those, right? They play them late at night. I always like to watch them where the words don't match up with their mouth. You know, two guys will come together and you see the face goes and then it'll say, want to fight? You know, there's a whole conversation going on. And always in those movies, there's the two schools of kung fu. There's the good school and then the bad school. And always when the master is gone, the best of the bad guys come into the good guy's school and they just kick heinies of all of the good guys, you know, and they're all getting beat up. And then all of a sudden, the master appears, you know, and then they come down and they come at him and he's just, you know, he's the floating in the air kind of kung fu guy, and he just, old man, blows them all away. Well, same idea. Jesus is away and the disciples are put to a problem they can't help. And the doctors of the law, who couldn't help them either, they immediately use this as an opportunity to start slamming the disciples and putting it to them. And so Jesus comes down. Interesting, in Mark chapter 9, it says, all the people, when they beheld him, were greatly amazed, and running to him, saluted him. Why were they greatly amazed? I don't know. I've heard some people suggest that perhaps he was still glowing a little bit, like Moses, when Moses was in the presence of God, that he was still shining and everybody saw him and they ran over. We don't know. But certainly, all the people run over, and he asks the scribes, what question are you with them? And that's when the guy speaks up and says what the problem is. He says, I have brought thee my son, Luke mentioning that it's his only son, which could be, by the way, translated only begotten son. Luke picks that out a bunch of times, talks about Jairus being his only son, his only daughter, the widow of Nain, whose only son died, that Jesus rose from the dead. That seems to be something that Luke picks up on. But he tells him about his son, which is possessed. And the spirit is tearing him. It's throwing him down. He's foaming. He's gnashing with his teeth. And Jesus' answer in verse 19 is the same one he gave in the other gospel. He answered them and says, O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him unto me. And they brought him unto him, and when he saw him, straightway the spirit tear him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming. And he asked his father, how long is it ago since this came unto him? And he said, of a child. Now, again, you have to understand, whenever Jesus asks a question, it's not because he lacks information. He's God. We're going to see in a minute in Luke where he discerns their thoughts. He knows what people think. It's never a matter of him trying to understand. It's a matter of him trying to bring something out. And he says, how long? And the guy says, of a child, which means literally since he was born, which shows you a couple things. First of all, this kid is tormented. The father is completely powerless to help him. And if you've ever had a sick kid, you understand what that feeling is like, about how you would do anything. There is no place you wouldn't go. There is no price you wouldn't pay. There is no fight you wouldn't fight to try to help your child. And to get in that place where you realize you're helpless. And this guy brought him to the scribes, and the scribes were powerless. They had no help. They had nothing to offer. And they were the ones who were the religious leaders of the day. In fact, you know, one of the sayings was, if only two people make it into heaven, one would be a scribe, the other one would be a Pharisee, because they knew the Bible. They were responsible for copying over the scriptures. Many of them had memorized great sections of it. And yet, with all of their learning, they were powerless, because all they had was an intellectual understanding of what the scriptures said. And so then they had heard of this Jesus. He had heard of this Jesus, and he brings his child to, Jesus isn't there, and they bring him to the disciples. And the disciples can't help him either. And at this point, the guy has got to be hopeless. And Jesus asks him, how long? When did this happen? And he says, as a child. This is not a punishment. This is not something the kid did to earn it. This is not, you know, the problem that this child has is something that happened to him before he was old enough to understand. It wasn't a judgment of sin in his life. It wasn't a, you know, that's not the case. And Jesus is bringing that point out. This is something that literally from birth. It says, oftentimes it casts him into the fire and into the waters to destroy him. If you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. If you can do anything. And you got to understand the desperation of this guy at this point. He's wondering, because I went to your disciples and they couldn't do anything. And remember, Jesus just sent them out a little while ago and gave them exousia, authority to go out and just blanketly heal whoever they wanted, cast out whatever devils they wanted. And then they came back. And apparently that was that particular gift for them was a limited time thing, just while they were out preparing his way, because now they can't do anything. They pray to cast this thing out of this kid, and it doesn't go. And this guy says, if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said unto him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. Now you have to understand, this is translated from the Greek. There's no punctuation in the original. And if you have, if you're reading a different version, New Living is one, I think the New American Standard, I looked at some of the different ones, they probably word that a little different. A lot of them have it rendered like this. The man says, if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help. And Jesus said, if you can, believe. All things are possible to him that believes, if you can. And I don't think Jesus is putting a trip on this man about it's your lack of faith. That's why this is happening. Because look, straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help thou my unbelief. You know, and that really, that's a great line right there. I believe, I do believe, but you know what? Could you help my unbelief? Because it isn't much. You know, and there are some people who would have you to believe that it's all a matter of the amount of faith you can work up. If you can just believe hard enough, and it's not, because I can believe with all of my might that I can step off the front of that building and I'll fly. And if I can utterly convince myself, I will step off the edge of that building and I'll realize it doesn't matter how much I believe. It matters in the ability of what I believed in. And if I believed in my ability to fly, I was sincerely wrong. You know, we see it every year. There are people who sincerely believe that the ice is thick enough on the lake to drive a truck on. And it's really sincere. They truly believe it because they exercise the faith of driving on thin ice. And they realize it has nothing to do with the power of your faith. It has to do with the object of your faith. And Jesus saying, if you can believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. And certainly, even if that man was having problems with unbelief, Jesus didn't have any problem with unbelief. He knew exactly who he was and what he was called to do and what the Lord had and what the Father enabled him to do. And he said, I believe. He said, just believe. And when Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the foul spirit, saying unto him, thou dumb and deaf spirit, I charge thee, come out of him and enter no more into him. And the spirit cried and rent him sore and came out of him. And he was as one dead, insomuch that many said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And here we see no fight, no argument, no, you have to go. I don't want to go. You have to go. It's just go. And it goes. There's none of that stuff is going on. Now, a couple things. First of all, I'm sure a lot of you guys have never seen anything like this. It's not like we deal with evil spirits all the time. But Jesus did all the time. A couple of reasons. One, I believe because his presence automatically incited a reaction in those who were dealing with it. This kid, for whatever reason, and had this problem from a child. And really, when you look at the story, in some ways, look, we're all that kid, okay? Because we all start out with a problem. And it's a problem we inherited from our parents. It's something we had at birth. It's called sin. And it doesn't matter how old, you know, how little your kids are, that's present. I never taught my kids to say mine. I never taught my kids to lie to me about taking cookies out of the jar. I never taught my kids to, you know, hit other children and steal their toys. Somehow it just was there. It was like inbred, and they were just waiting for the chance to be able to say mine, because that one just comes out, you know, you're saying dad, dad, they're saying mine, you know, it's there. And we all have a problem that we have no answer for, and it's hopeless, but yet there is one who came and can deal with that problem. Now, as far as the idea of, you know, generational curses, you know, it doesn't matter, you've inherited something from your grandfather, he was a witch doctor, and so you've ended up, you know, with this generational curse. And even though you're a Christian, it's still there. And, you know, somehow Jesus, you asked him to save you and set you free, and he sort of did. But until you remember that one specific thing you did and confess it, he's powerless against it. Baloney. Read Ezekiel 18. Ezekiel 18, the whole chapter deals with the fact that, you know what, you guys have been going around using this saying that the father drank sour grapes and the kid's teeth are set on edge. In other words, dad does something and the kids pay for it. He says, I don't want you saying that anymore. Because when somebody acts the way they're supposed to, I'll deal with them as if they're righteous. And when somebody is wicked, if he has a kid and he's wicked, then it's the kid's fault and I'll deal with the kid. But if that wicked kid has a son and they're righteous, I'll treat them as righteousness. This whole idea of inherited generational curses is not scriptural. The other thing, I understand there are some people who are of the mindset that Christians can be possessed. I think that really, really negates the power of God. Can we be messed with? Yes, we can. Did Paul have a thorn in the flesh that was a messenger from Satan sent to buffet him? Yes, he did. Did he pray to be delivered of it? Yes. And God said, no, I gave that to you in order to keep you humble. You know, are we told to take up the shield of faith and to protect ourselves from, you know, the attack of the enemy? Certainly he comes in and he assaults our mind and whatever else. But as far as being owned or possessed, no. And, you know, I understand, look, there are some Christians, some I really respect, who really hold that opinion. I don't see it in the Bible, and I've looked at it, and I've read the books, and I've listened to the tapes. I do know this. I think we have a tendency sometimes to focus so much on the devil that we forget about Jesus. And I'd never see any account in any of the Gospels where someone draws close to the Lord and they're not set free. So for me, my goal, I'm just going to talk about Jesus. And that stuff will go. And certainly that's what we see here. He brings him to Jesus. There's no argument. The people are blown away by his authority. Now, the disciples, when this happens, they say unto him, in verse 28 of Mark 9, when they come into the house, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast him out? And he said unto them, this kind can come forth by nothing but prayer and fasting. Okay. Did you notice in that account an instance where Jesus prayed and fasted? He walked down the hill. He gets down the hill. There's a demon-possessed kid. And they bring him to Jesus. Jesus says, go. And he's healed. He didn't pray. And he didn't fast. He just said, go. Well, if you look, of course, he was up on the mountain. What was he doing up on the mountain? He was praying. And he was, I don't know whether he's fasting there, but that certainly was a habit of his life. There's a section in Nehemiah that I really like. Nehemiah was they were in bondage. Israel was in captivity, and he was the cupbearer to the king. And he finds out in Nehemiah chapter 1 that his homeland is wrecked. And then in Nehemiah chapter 2, he gets before the king, and he's sad. And it's a big deal because anybody around the king is always supposed to be happy because nobody likes to deal with someone who's sad. And he literally could have been put to death for having a bum look on his face. And he was the wine taster for the king. In Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 3, the king asks him why is he sad. And in verse 3, he says, "And he said unto the king, Let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? And the king said unto me, For what dost thou make request?" In other words, okay, what do you want? And he says, "So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said unto the king, If it please the king, and thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it." So right in the middle, you have a conversation, and he says, "Well, why do you expect me not to be bummed? My hometown is trashed." And the king says, "What do you want?" And Nehemiah says, "So I prayed, and I said, King," I mean, and it was that fast. It was a, "Oh, Lord, please help me." You know, I mean, that was his prayer. It couldn't have been any more than that, because it was while he was going, he went, "Please help." And then he said what he was going to say. Now, but the thing is, if you look at Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 4, when he first found out about it, it says, "And it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and I wept and I mourned certain days and I fasted and I prayed before the God of heaven." See, when Jesus came down and they were confronted with, you're confronted with the enemy overwhelmingly, it's a little late to start your fast right then. You know, it's a little late to get... What really needs to happen is you need to be in, and we need to be, I'm saying you, okay, I need to be in a position of praying, in a position of fasting, in a position of seeking the Lord and denying myself, because he just talked about, if anyone wants to follow me, let him deny himself. I need to be keeping my desires, my appetites down so that I can hear from the Lord. I need to be in prayer so I'm in line with his will, so that when we walk into a situation like that, it's not like, "Oh, okay, now it's time to start the fast." No, it's too late at that point. It needs to be something that is an attitude. It's a habit for us. You know, there's some habits that are good and some that are bad. That's a good one. I was talking with somebody from the church here the other day who he and his wife have decided that they're going to start fasting one day a week. One day a week, they're just going to set aside to pray and fast, you know. And that's hard. In fact, that's worse. I'd rather do like a week one than I would a day one, because the day's the worst day. Once you get past day one, you know, your body kind of quiets down that first day. But to do that every week, to practice that, and to make, and it's not like a God's diet plan, okay? It's not a way to lose weight. It's a way to bring your body under so that, you know, deny yourself and then take that time to seek the Lord and hear from him. And, you know, personally, I think it's a great thing. Some of us are going to, this coming week, and you're welcome to join us if you want, we're going to be fasting as we approach Easter, because we know it's an opportunity we're going to get to deliver the gospel and to minister to some people who normally wouldn't hear it. You know, my prayer is that we'll fill this room, we'll fill all our chairs. And so, you know, we're going to pray and we're going to fast so that when the time comes, we're not going to be like, what do we do now? You know, maybe perhaps the Lord will speak to us throughout this week and we'll be in a place where he can use us. And then back in Luke chapter 9, at the end of that thing, we're almost done here. Luke chapter 9, verse 44, after everybody's amazed at what happened, Jesus again takes this opportunity and he says, "Let these sayings sink down in your ears, for the Son of Man shall be delivered into the hands of men." But they understood not his saying, and it was hid from them that they perceived it not, and they feared to ask him of that saying. And he tries to tell them over and over again, "I'm going to be crucified. I'm not here to set up an earthly kingdom. I am here to deliver from sin. And I'm going to be crucified, but I'm going to be raised again." And it says flat out, they didn't understand. It was hidden from them. They didn't perceive it, and they were scared to ask. And you can tell for sure they didn't get it, because look what it says next. "And there arose a reasoning among them, which of them should be greatest." Because, you know, they figure there's going to be, he's going to rule, and there's going to be, you know, 12 thrones, but somebody's going to sit right next to him. You know, Peter, James, and John figure they got the inside track, because they're thinking, "We were up on the hill. We knows what he looks like underneath that skin. You know, you guys, I mean, he told us not to say what happened up in that mountain, but let's just say we know it's going to be one of us." And James and John are saying, "Well, we're going to be sitting on the right and the left, Pete. God didn't tell us to shut up. We at least knew to close our mouths, so apparently it's going to be one of us." But they don't get it. They're reasoning who should be the greatest, you know, arguing about position. And look at verse 47. Jesus, perceiving the thought of their heart, he knows their thoughts, he took a child and set him by him and said unto them, "Whosoever shall receive this child in my name receiveth me. Whosoever shall receive me receives him that sent me. For he that is least among you all, the same shall be great." And here they are, concerned about position, concerned about working their way to the top. And Jesus says, "You guys don't get it. Come here." And he grabs a little kid. A couple things with that. One, kids were around, which means he was the type of guy that parents
felt okay about being around their kids. Second of all, the little kid didn't go, ow, and run away. The kid actually thought, hey, Jesus is cool. I don't mind going up to him. So he comes to Jesus, and Jesus says, look, whoever receives this child in my name receives me. And because rather than, you know, greatness is not by how high up you work into some organization. Greatness in the kingdom of God is how willing you are to deal with the least individual, you know, to take the lowest position. I mean, you look at what's going on in children's ministry, and the kids are in there now. There are some that are being taught the word. They're singing songs under the Lord. They're being taught in a level that they can understand. There's other ones that are in there just holding little babies and dealing with poopy diapers and everything so that people can sit in here and hear the word. They're a whole lot greater than me sitting up front, because their acts are allowing people to hear the gospel, allowing their heart to be ministered to. You know, if you're looking for a way to work your way up in the kingdom, aim for the bottom. You know, I've had people come up to me before, oh, I got a heart to teach. I just want to teach. Where can I teach? You know, first day in the door, I just want to teach. Show me, I want to be a teacher. Well, that's great. You want to be a teacher. Super. Why don't you show me whether or not you're ready to teach? Why don't you clean toilets for a while? Or why don't you hold some babies? Or why don't you park some cars? Or why don't you do some of the things that show me that your heart's right? Because, you know, again, the right words don't mean anything. It's the attitude of the heart. And because we'll see that. Well, look what happens next. And after he says that, John answered and said, Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and we forbade him, because he follows not with us. And Jesus said unto him, forbid him not, for he that is not against us is for us. You know, because here's a guy casting out devils. Now, they just were unable to do this. They were just confronted with it. They were powerless. Jesus deals with it. And then they said, well, we saw some guy doing it in your name, so we told him to quit it because he wasn't one of the clique. And Jesus said, oh, no, you don't get it, okay? If he's not against us, he's for us. Now, certainly, there's a couple things out of that. One is there is a line, and you are either for or against. There's no neutral. You're either on one side of the street or the other. The one in the middle of the road is the one that gets run over. You're either for or against. There's no middle ground. And with that, I mean, this guy, whoever it was having success in dealing with the enemy in the name of Jesus. Now, Acts chapter 19, there is an instance, because everybody would, you know, they saw the success that was going on with doing things in Jesus' name. Acts chapter 19, verse 13, there's a cool little story. It says, then certain of the vagabond Jews, exorcists, took upon them to call over them which had evil spirits the name of the Lord Jesus, saying, we adjure you by Jesus, whom Paul preaches. And there were seven sons of one Sceva, a Jew, and chief of the priests, which did so. And an evil spirit answered and said, Jesus I know, and Paul I know, but who are you? And the man in whom the evil spirit was leapt on them and overcame them and prevailed against them, so that they fled out of the house naked and wounded. And here is an instance where these people had seen it going on, and so they figured, well, it must be the magic formula. If I just say in Jesus' name, and just in case you don't know who Jesus is, it's Jesus who Paul preaches, you know, so they drop in names, and the devil says, oh, I know Jesus, and I know Paul, but I don't know you, and he goes after them, and they run out, you know, naked and bleeding. And the difference is words and relationship. The difference is knowing of somebody and knowing somebody. You know, I don't know what background you guys are from. And you might have spent some time in religious organizations where you did some things and you put in your time, you paid your dues, you know, did your offering envelopes and whatever else. Knowing about him is not the same as knowing him. Knowing his name is not the same as asking him into your life. You know, those devils could look and hear those names and realize, well, I know who Jesus is, and I can look at you and see that you don't know who he is. And he's not in you. You got no power over me. Now, and so let me encourage you. We're going to pray and we're going to close. If you have been living your life knowing about Jesus but never knowing him, if you are still like that boy who has been bound all your life, if you've never asked him to come in and to forgive your sins and to be the Lord of your life, you don't know him. And you will not know peace. And you will not know power until you surrender. You know, like he said in the beginning, if any man follows me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily and follow me. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much that you are a God who wants to personally know us, Lord, and wants us to know you, who are continually revealing yourself to us, Lord, who have given us the testimony of your word. Father, I pray if there's anybody here who doesn't know you, Lord, or if they've known about you, they've seen you working in other lives, but they've never asked you to be Lord of their life, Father, you would give them the courage to come forward, pray with me, Lord, and start a life that is unlike any other. And Lord, our prayer is as we come into this week when everybody's going to be thinking about God, Lord, that you would give us opportunities to be able to share our faith, to share our relationship with you, not share religion, not, you know, Calvary Chapel or Lincoln Christian Fellowship or whatever church we go to, but Lord, share the Lord that lives in our hearts. And Father, to that end, help us, Lord, to be men and women of prayer, Lord, men and women who are practicing self-denial, Lord, that we may hear from you and be used of you and not be brought into bondage of our appetites. Lord, I pray for my brothers and sisters here that you would just fill them with your spirit, Lord, and you would give them opportunity. We thank you and praise you in Jesus' name. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.